first of a 10-part series sponsored by the Pennsylvania Humanities Council about the slogans that we use to talk about Philadelphia. As you can see from the promotion card, hopefully everyone will have got one of these, there's a lot on this little card, but you can see that we have partnered with many, many organizations, many scholars and civic leaders and citizens of the community, and a lot of people have joined together on what truly is a city-wide, region-wide discussion about what is it about Greater Philadelphia that makes it special and unique. And this is going to happen over the next 12 months. Tonight's topic is the City of Brotherly Love, and the ideas were launched, as you probably saw on the weekend, which was a rather handsome full page in the Philadelphia Current section, and of course also on WHYY's fabulous new website, Newsworks. And it was written by Chris Satullo, the Executive Director of News and Civic Engagement at WHYY. He's over there. If you take umbrage with anything he's written, he's over there.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Tonight you'll be treated to what I'm sure is going to be a very stimulating panel discussion that is being moderated by Gene Sutherland. And before we introduce Gene, it's actually my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Charlene Myers, the Director of the Mid-Atlantic Regional Centre for the Humanities and the Associate Professor of History at Rutgers Camden, where she teaches courses in public, urban and US history. Charlene is the author of Independence Hall in American Memory that was produced by the Pennsylvania Press in 2002. She received the Philadelphia Athenaeum Literary Award for that work. And she has also published articles in our own Pennsylvania Magazine of History and Biography and the Pennsylvania History, as well as Public Historian. In fact, Charlene's pretty much published everywhere. She's worked on many public history projects throughout this city and worked with many, many organizations, including Independence Park, Valley Forge National Historic Park, Eastern State Penitentiary, the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. And she was on the oversight committee for the President's House, which is a whole other story, which there is wine at the back of the table that will help the conversation, I'm sure. Previously, however, and you'll probably get a sense of the way that the encyclopedia is really about civic engagement, Charlene has a wonderful background in journalism. She worked as an editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And then she also worked as a journalist, where she was one of the writers who won Pulitzer Prize in general local reporting for the Fort Wayne News Centennial for coverage of the floods that ravaged that city in 1982. She's here along with her co-editors. I should point out Howard Gillette, who's right at the back, sitting next to Tammy, but Howard is a co-editor of the Encyclopedia, and Randall Miller, who I have not seen walk in the door, but maybe he will. And the three of them have truly been a sort of a triumvirate of energy and power and ideas as they try and birth this baby called the Encyclopedia of Greater Philadelphia. So welcome tonight, Anne Charlene.
Now you know what a child reporter I was in 1982. welcome, everyone. Thanks so much to the Historical Society for hosting us this evening and being our partner in this series of programs, the Greater Philadelphia Roundtable. And thanks to the numerous civic partners, and there are people in this audience who have helped us organize other programs down the line that you'll be able to enjoy as you continue with us. We're very grateful for the Philadelphia Inquirer and WHYY Newsworks for helping us to call more attention to the essays that are the foundation of our discussions, and to the Mural Arts Program, which has been assisting us in selecting illustrations that are appearing on the Encyclopedia's website. The Helping Hands mural that you see behind my shoulder here was created by Robert Bullock, who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight, but he's the artist who has created 14 murals around Philadelphia, and also the founder of the Coalition Ingenue Self-Taught Artist Collaborative, which is a wonderful organization that assists artists who have been homeless or who have mental health challenges or other barriers to promoting their own artwork to help that art find its public. And so thanks to Robert for allowing the use of his image. And perhaps part of our discussion tonight can be about the mural. 60-year-old helping hands. So part of the idea behind this series is that Philadelphia is really a place of multiple personalities. You know, we have some of these personalities that come to us from the founding of the city of brotherly love, the holy experiment, the green country town. We have some personalities that emerged along the way in Philadelphia's history, like Workshop of the World, or Corrupt and Contented, which will be fun in November, the week after the Philadelphia election. We'll see how that turns out. And we have some personalities that we've been intentionally. Philadelphia, get to know us. Philadelphia, the place that loves you back. So tonight we're beginning what I think is an unprecedented exploration of these many personalities of Philadelphia's present and its history. And perhaps along the way we'll discover our common ground among these multiple ways of seeing Philadelphia. This is all part of the project to create an encyclopedia of Greater Philadelphia, as Kim mentioned. We envision this as a digital information resource that we'll build as we go. So this discussion tonight is part of the building. The panel discussion and the questions and answers will be summarized and put on our website as quickly as we can do that. We're also audio recording the panel discussion tonight, and we'll post that audio file so that people can continue to learn from us and from you and to engage with the project. You have comment cards that invite you to jot things down as they occur to you during the session this evening. We'll collect those at the end. Those become part of the encyclopedia. And your very presence here helps us to demonstrate that there is interest and enthusiasm for this project, and that helps us to build the financial support we will need in order to carry it out. So thank you very much for that. The order of proceedings this evening is pretty informal. We'll start out with the panel discussion for about 40 minutes. Then we'll open the floor to questions for about 20 minutes. And we'll end up by dividing up into some smaller groups so that everyone has an opportunity to discuss and to have some more one-on-one conversation with our panelists this evening. So it is my pleasant duty to introduce the moderator for this evening, who will then introduce the panelists. Jean Sutherland, who is to my immediate left, has come down from Bethlehem today. Thank you, Jean. She's professor of history at Lehigh University and received her PhD from Temple, so she's coming home a little bit. And I always say the Temple people need to stick together, Angie. We're both Temple alumni. Among her many publications are the book Quakers and Slavery, A Divided Spirit, which won the Alfred E. Driscoll Publication Prize of the New Jersey Historical Commission. Very pertinent to tonight's subject, she was an editor of three volumes of the papers of William Penn, and she co-authored Freedom by Degrees, Emancipation in Pennsylvania's Aftermath, and American Passages, A History of the United States. She's currently working on a project that is tentatively titled South River, Native Americans and Colonists in the Development of Delaware Valley Society, 1631 to 1767. So who better could we have to moderate this discussion of the early history and its resonance for us today, the city of brotherly love.
Thank you very much, Charlie. I'm very pleased to be back here in the city of brotherly love, and also at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, because when I was a member of the staff of the Papers of William Penn, we were here, and I did my work here. So it's great fun to be here. I'm very pleased to introduce our distinguished panel, and then I will be asking them a series of questions, and they will then provide us with their very interesting comments on the city of brotherly love over the last 300 plus years. And then, as Charlene mentioned, we'll have a chance to talk as a group. Stephen Glassman is chairperson of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission and vice chairperson of the Governor's Cabinet on Disability Rights. He has practiced architecture throughout the U.S. as a principal of his own firm, Art and Architectural Design, for over 25 years. He holds advanced degrees from Brown and Yale universities and was a graduate of Harvard's program for senior executives in state and local government. He has served on the Human Relations Commission since 2002, when he was the first openly gay individual to receive a gubernatorial appointment subject to Senate confirmation to a board or commission in the United States, a first. He is a tireless advocate for the civil rights of ethnic and racial minorities, women, religious groups, older workers, and people with disabilities, as well as the expansion of current civil rights laws to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Colleen Nicole Gross is Associate Professor of History and Politics and Director of Africana Studies at Drexel University. She holds a BA in Africana Studies from Cornell University and graduate degrees in American Civilization and History from the University of Pennsylvania. She has received numerous awards and fellowships, most notably a Ford postdoctoral fellowship and two research fellowships at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. Her book covered Amazons, Crime, Violence, and Black Women in the City of Brotherly Love, 1880 to 1910, received the John Hope Franklin Center Manuscript Prize and the Letitia Woods Brown Memorial Book Prize from the Association of Black Women Historians. Chris Atola is Executive Director of News and Civic Dialogue at WHYY. He joined the Public Media Service in December 2008 after nearly 20 years at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's a graduate of Williams College. At the Inquirer, Chris served as editorial page editor and a columnist among various positions. He founded the paper's Citizen Voices program of civic dialogues on public issues, and in 2006 co-founded the Penn Project for Civic Engagement. Chris has won more than 50 awards for columns, editorials, reporting, and civic engagement. Before coming to the Inquirer, he worked at the Express newspaper in Easton, Pennsylvania, my neighborhood right now, where he was assistant managing director, editor, and wrote a syndicated column. Okay, so I'm going to start by asking a question, and then each of the panelists will have the opportunity to respond. And I hope that we'll provide an excellent dialogue, or the preparation for an excellent dialogue as we move through the evening. Okay, Philadelphia has had a long history in which forces for and against brotherly or sisterly love have challenged each other. I'd like to ask each of the panelists to briefly discuss a social political incident or movement that helps us understand better the record of Philadelphians in human rights.
You want your first?
Sure.
Okay. Pleasure to be here tonight, and thank you, Charlene, for organizing this. I think what I'm going to do is talk through the lens of human relations and human rights, since that's the job that I've had for the last 9 years on behalf of the Commonwealth. And I would like to start by looking at something that happened very recently here that I think is emblematic of both the challenges that Philadelphia has faced for many hundreds of years and the ways in which we tend to resolve things in the city, and it's particularly in response to the article that was in the Inquirer this morning. About a year and a half ago, you all will remember a story that made national news for several weeks and has repeatedly been on the television and in the media for the last year and a half, and that is the violence against 39 Asian American students in South Philadelphia High School. A case which came immediately to our agency and which we held not only public investigatory hearings on, but took a whole series of cases from individuals and their parents. There were Thai, Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Chinese students who were the victims of very exceptional violence, except that as we did the hearings, we understood that this had been going on for about 35 years and that it had simply been ignored or relegated to a very low priority status, both in the school district, in the city government, and these were really individuals who had no ability to get redress for their grievances. And after a year of investigations and public hearings and deposing witnesses and subpoenaing documents from the school district, we finally brought the Department of Justice in, and we came up with a settlement that I think we're all extremely proud of, because it was a win for the city of Philadelphia. It had the endorsement of the school district and of all of the major community groups from the Asian American community who were involved in this case. But it's important to recognize that it took incidents of violence that had been going on for many years, and where a community that was relatively new to the city of Philadelphia in the size as it grew over 3 decades, it really created an opportunity for us, but it was also a tremendous hardship for those who had to live through a whole series of prejudicial incidents that culminated in a series of violent incidents. And that mirrors, I think, the way in which we struggle through welcoming but resisting new population groups into the city. And I don't mean to suggest that it's only Philadelphia, because by far Philadelphia is the most progressive and liberal city in the Commonwealth, without any exception. And in fact, many people believe it's not even part of the Commonwealth. But the fact is that Philadelphia has been both a leader and a follower in these movements. And as we get into some of the other questions, I think I can also look at this through the lens of the LGBT rights movement, something I have a particular expertise in, as well as the movements which have really established the field of human rights and civil rights for us, starting, of course, with people of color and working through a series of other civil rights movements that have attached themselves to those legislative successes. I'll pass the microphone.
Thank you, because I was wondering, how am I going to get the microphone over gracefully without sort of knocking over the water?
The water, right.
All right, well, good evening. I just want to take a minute to thank Charlene again for organizing this event. I think the turnout tonight, in spite of the weather, is a testament to your efforts. Thank you. So, can you hear me?
No.
Great. No? Uh-oh. Can you hear me now? Okay. All right, so thank you. And also thank you, Jean, for this really great and provocative question. So I've been ruminating on this for a little bit, and I know that it's kind of a sore spot, but in some respects, I think that the sort of history behind it and the actual exhibit itself, the President's House, in some respect really embodies some of the complexities about the kind of tensions that I think the city is sort of roiled in. You know, so if we take a minute to think about sort of the history of Philadelphia, in some respects, the fact that we are kind of the cradle of the country's democracy, right? And we also, a state sort of led the movement away from enslavement by initiating an act for the gradual abolition of slavery in 1780. So in some respects, there are all these sort of very progressive historical events right up beside sort of our countenance for enslavement. And sort of the irony of it with respect to George Washington inhabiting this house with 9 enslaved African Americans. And he did it in a way where he rotated his servants so that they would not be subject to the 1780 statute, which would have worked to grant them freedom if they had had 6 months of continued residency. So there's this sort of unique irony about sort of our proximity to kind of initiating democracy and fomenting a democratic country right up beside this institution of enslavement. But I think that history paired with sort of the struggle around how to represent it today also demonstrates how deep those divides still are, because it was a really contentious battle about how to talk about sort of our role in the nation's founding and also acknowledge this sort of paradoxical relationship with enslavement that involved conflicts with the Park Service, with African American community groups, with all sorts of civic organizations. And I think someone mentioned it earlier, right, that this was a contested issue, and in some respects people are still not happy with this outcome. But the fact that there was a compromise that was reached, I think, is also sort of indicative of what is so interesting to me about the city and what I think Chris's essay really captures, which is this sort of tortured duality, right? We have a compromise that acknowledges democracy and slavery, even though it might be tenuous and fragile. So I think that's where I'll stop, and I'm going to try to now gracefully pass this thing over.
As we were talking before the panel formally started, I mentioned a line I'd written on this essay, but on another similar topic a couple of weeks ago, talking about Philadelphia and what it takes to master what goes on in Philadelphia. And the thought that occurred to me when I was thinking about that was, if you can't handle paradox, pal, you can't hang out in Philadelphia. I've been training and orienting new journalists who come to the city for about 20 years now. We have one of them here from WHYY who came to the city fairly recently. And what I always tell them is that Philadelphia is like any other place, only more so. Whatever it is, we have it in particularly high relief, we have it in high octane, and we turn it into a double helix as quickly as humanly possible. When Stephen and you were talking, I was thinking of another fairly recent incident that's reminiscent, occurred in nearly the same neighborhood, part of South Philadelphia, Gray's Ferry. Do you remember the drama Gray's Ferry? I guess it would have been about 14 years ago, is that long ago? 12 years ago, where there were some incidents of violence against African-American youth in Gray's Ferry, not unfortunately an uncommon occurrence. But the community was in an uproar, enough of an uproar that it caught the attention of Minister Louis Farrakhan, who decided that he would come to Philadelphia and grace us with a march of his group, and there was a tremendous reaction against that idea. I was on the editorial board of Inquirer at that time, and we were on the editorial board, essentially a microcosm of that conflict. Our editorial page editor at that time was an extremely devout Jew, who had strong feelings about Minister Farrakhan's feelings about Jews. We had at that time a Jewish, at least nominally Jewish mayor, Ed Rendell, and he was in quite a pickle because certainly the African-American members of our board, of our community, were absolutely intent on the notion that what Minister Farrakhan was going to do with the march was absolutely appropriate to bring attention to the violations of rights of African-American youth in the neighborhood. And a lot of white citizens were generally worried that it would cause more violence, and Jewish citizens were in particular upset about it. I have to say, I thought it was one of Ed Rendell's finest moments. He not only allowed the march to take place, he welcomed Minister Farrakhan. He basically found a way to straddle the complexities and the ironies and the paradoxes of the situation, which is, whatever else you think about the guy, one of the reasons why he actually was a great mayor, because he actually rose to the occasion of trying to master the paradoxes of Philadelphia and sort of stand astride them in multiple camps at once rather than choosing one side or the other. And I sort of saw that when I got this assignment from Charlene. I did what anybody would do, particularly journalists that were getting an assignment. I procrastinated for 3 months and didn't think about it. And then Charlene called me up, knowing that I was a journalist, and said, "Hey, you know, this thing is due in 2 weeks." And then I started thinking about it. And I realized that the name City of Brotherly Love was unusual in that it's a name that is an aspiration. Most of the names of that happened in colonies were either named after geographic features, Indian names, or they were basically flattery of some patron on the other side of the ocean. William Penn decided to embed an aspiration in the name of the city. So that sets us up either to meet and rise to that aspiration or to fail and essentially have the name be a mockery or an irony. And I just see everything we've talked about and everything that's happened since William Penn wandered around these shores is essentially a duel, a battle between, is this name eventually going to become a destiny, a push towards living out an aspiration, or is it going to become an irony, a mockery? And I don't think the battle's done. I think it continues. And since we all came up with three relatively recent examples, I think that's a great testimony to the fact that we're still struggling.
I was going to ask Chris first to give a summary of his essay.
So I worked it in, so we're good.
We've got, so thank you so much for doing that. Okay, and he also, this answer, I think also helped me into the next question that I had. Over the 329 years since its founding, is Philadelphia's record on human rights better or worse than that of other U.S. cities? And has its record improved or declined over time?
I can speak to that from a number of contexts. I think Philadelphia generally has actually been in the forefront of human rights struggles in the country, but I think the expectations have been higher of Philadelphia precisely because it has been the home of liberty and where the original documents were crafted that created this nation. So Philadelphia has been looked to with a certain level of elevated understanding of these issues that other cities have essentially gotten a pass on for many years. Pennsylvania, for example, and this really emanated from Philadelphia, was in the very forefront of passing legislation before the federal government did in all of the areas related to employment law, housing, public accommodations, education, credit and lending. All of those laws existed here before they existed in the United States in Congress. So we have a long history of providing leadership in those areas. The one area that we have fallen short on, and those areas actually include disability. We had a law here in Pennsylvania 16 years before the federal law passed in 1990. Our housing law was 9 years before the federal law. Our employment law was 8 years before the federal law. But in lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender rights, we have been very far behind the curve in Pennsylvania, although Philadelphia has been rather early in the movement. In 1982, they passed amendments to the Fair Employment Practices Act, which was the name at that time, that added sexual orientation to the law. In the year 2000, they came back and added protections for gender identity expression to the law. And again, in the country, that was relatively early. But I think it's important to recognize that this is a very small window into a much larger arena when you're discussing legislation, because the resistance in Pennsylvania to what was initiated here in Philadelphia has almost been more insistent and larger precisely because of the resentment of Philadelphia's more liberal culture than it has been in other states in the United States. So Philadelphia, by its very progressive nature, has created a backlash in the rest of the Commonwealth, an issue which I think is probably worthy of some discussion at some point this evening, because the relationship between Philadelphia and every other part of the state primarily is more difficult because of social issues, not economic issues, not other cultural issues. It's the social issues that deal with human rights, the issues we're talking about tonight, that really demarcate Philadelphia from the rest of this state, and which have provided actually leadership around the country when it comes to protections for people in various marginalized or minority status, particularly the rights of those with disabilities. That's been a very early movement here in Philadelphia. Women have had protections in a variety of ways, and there are women's organizations that have had a lot of national leadership and strength that emanated here in Philadelphia. So the city has a long history of being progressive, but it also has, I think, lost its way on this one very important issue from the standpoint of sexual orientation and gender identity in the last decade or two, and I think we have fallen behind many other parts of the country in that area, and it's particularly burdensome because that is the cutting-edge movement today in this country that defines where people are with regard to their embracing of human rights for everyone or their resistance and use of pretext or excuses to avoid having to enter into that particular social movement.
So this was the question I really struggled with. For me, I think that it really is an ebb and flow. And in some respects, I do think that it kind of mirrors and parallels sort of the broader history. In some respects, I think the city is very progressive, and I agree with you that there are many sort of social kind of issues around social justice where I think we tend to be ahead of the curve in some respects. But also, it has sort of a kind of conservative elements too, and I think there are points where I know in certain pockets of African American history, it's referred to as up south. So, you know, there are these ways where it is, you know, again, there's that duality. So I'm trying to think of some examples. So even sort of early examples are initially, on one hand, we have this sort of very progressive and robust abolitionist movement in the 19th century, but there's also sort of a backlash, and your essay talks about some of the sort of nativist riots and also that. It's also a moment where African-American men who initially were able to vote in Philadelphia were actually disfranchised in the 1830s. So they don't actually get the vote back again until after the Civil War. So we're almost sort of, we're ahead of the curve, and then there was this kind of conservative constriction that strips those rights only to kind of have it be granted again later. So I think that there is a real kind of ebb and flow, and I think that's true for a lot of the social movements. But at the same time, and I agree with you, I do think that we certainly are behind, I think, the times with respect to LGBT legislation, but there also have been some really progressive pockets in terms of LGBT activism in sort of the 60s and 70s, and even kind of having one of the first kind of nation's gay newspapers, right? The Philadelphia Gay News actually is very sort of cutting edge in this respect. So again, it's this complicated kind of tension, I think, between some more progressive elements, or at least elements that I think are progressive, and some pieces that tend to be a little bit more backwards. And I even think that's true, I don't want to drone on too long, but even with respect to the role that we play in terms of criminal justice, this is sort of, you know, initially, I don't know if folks are aware, but Philadelphia actually sort of started the penitentiary movement. The country's first penitentiary actually was in the city of Brotherly Love. And at that time, it was a real humanitarian effort because it was a move away from corporal punishment. So it was actually sort of swept up into this notion of democracy, right? That brutalizing people for, you know, crimes was associated with the monarchy and this kind of out antiquated sort of repression. So by instead moving to kind of adjudicated sentences and having people serve time, they thought that that would be more progressive and in keeping with democratic ideals. Right, so we sort of spearheaded this movement that I think initially had some admirable goals, right? There was a sort of a humane sort of aspect to it, and even wrapped up in sort of religious ideals in terms of the solitary confinement pieces, right? Wanting people to sort of do penitence, right? If they could be redeemed somehow, they could come back into the community and be better for it. So they actually sort of even believed that someone who committed crimes could be sort of redeemed and then returned to the community. And then, of course, when the penitentiary became sort of this ultimate failure with respect to overcrowding and corruption and abuses, and it started to sort of be kind of a home where crime was taught rather than eradicated, they still sort of clung to the idea of punishment through confinement, but the attitude changed. It wasn't that the institution sort of failed, it was that somehow the people themselves who were in it were wrong. So, and I think we've sort of maintained that nationwide, even now, to the point where we sort of have the dubious distinction, right, of being, you know, one of the countries that has the most, almost, what is it, 5% of the population is now in prison. So there's this issue of mass incarceration now.
1%.
It was 1%. Okay.
Let's not make it worse than
that. Some massive, okay, it's 1%. Some huge number. It's 2 million people.
It's almost 3 million.
Right. Who are, in some respects, involved in criminal justice. And within that, folks of color, particularly African Americans, are profoundly overrepresented. So it's talk now about the ways that sort of confinement and criminal justice is becoming the new sort of segregation once again. So I think that our role in history is significant because I think we do sort of symbol as we lead, we initiate some of these trends, but we also are sort of at the forefront of when there are some real failures and tensions with respect to them. So it's worthwhile to sort of study our history and I think to keep up with it for sure.
I should caution about the fact that it shall become abundantly clear as the evening goes on. I am not a historian. I'm really pretending to be one up here with this distinguished panel. But I did want to mention one other form of human rights that matters a lot to me that is enshrined in our First Amendment written here in the city, though ratified elsewhere. And that is the right of freedom to worship and freedom of conscience. And that was definitely embedded in the idea of the city of brotherly love in William Penn's charter, although not perfectly realized by William Penn. But I think it becomes part of the DNA of the city. And I think if you look at the history of the city, there has been a lot of religious activism here. There have been faiths and denominations founded here. And again, in that cycle of the failure to live up to high aspiration, but the aspiration still being available to those who want to dissent or rebel or protest, you have the example of Richard Allen and Absalom mm-hmm. Jones creating a new church out of the failure of the church that they belong to treat them as fully human, and that is a cycle that repeats and repeats throughout history. So I think that's a good point. I think Stephen said, this is not a disagreement, but you just sort of made me have a thought. Economics may not be the source of the contention between Pennsylvania or Alabama or whatever we're going to call it tonight and Philadelphia, but economics are clearly part of this story of rights.
Absolutely.
It's much easier to extend rights when the economy is going good. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to go to Atlanta as part of the Civic Exchange run by the Economy League, and we were subjected to, we endured 3 or 4 days in a hotel room listening to Atlantans tell us how great they were and how they were the city too busy to hate. Meanwhile, the parade of speakers was telling us how actually deeply divided the city and the region it really still was. But one of my takeaways from there is when your population is increasing thanks to various benefits of economic growth, global trends, and federal policy, when your population is growing and the wealth of your region, triples in the space of 20 years, it's a lot easier to at least adopt a generous attitude about rights. One of the problems for Philadelphia since World War II is progress for the country has mostly meant a shrinking or at least stable economic pie for the Philadelphians who are here. And in that context, the new, the other, the immigrant, the African-American, the Asian-American is much more likely by the, longer-term resident, it's the white American, the ethnic working class, to be seen as a threat to be opposed. And these battles get worked out, not really necessarily on the economic front, but on the rights front. So I think if we've had not the most outstanding record over the last 50, 60 years, I think you really have to look at the fact that the winds of the global economy have been extremely unkind to the working class in Philadelphia. It sets them up in a mode of feeling victimized, because in some real ways they actually have been victimized.
May I quickly just expand on a point that both of my colleagues made here, because I think it's quite important. When you were talking about the prison system, Pennsylvania, and I'm particularly emphasizing Philadelphia because the source of this is in Philadelphia, even though prisoners get moved to other parts of the state where that causes a certain amount of friction in other communities. We have the worst numbers in the United States with regard to the disproportionate number of African Americans and Hispanics who are in prison related to their percentage in the population. It's 5.8 times their percentage in the population are in prison here in Pennsylvania. And for people who are under the age of 25, it's 6.8 times. So that's an extraordinary disproportionate way of watching the subtle and nuanced effects of institutionalized racism make itself evident in the way this conflation of economics and social policy that both of my colleagues just referenced, it comes out in a way that allows us to further establish social policy in the amount of money that we allocate towards prisons. If you notice in the current budget that's been proposed, there's one of the very few areas that has an increase in the state budget is for prisons and for the state police. And who are we putting in prison? I think it's very important that we look at that because it is mostly marginalized population that ends up in prison. And then when you look at how difficult it is to actually get a job when you emerge from prison, it further explains the higher unemployment rates that are dramatically higher for young people of color four times the national average. So I just wanted to toss that into the mix.
Thank you. For the last question, I want to quote just briefly from Chris's essay, and I think we'll take a little bit less time on this because we'll be building on your discussion already. But in his article, Chris writes, "Like the nation that chose this city, and not by accident, as the spot to declare the define itself, Philadelphia has struggled to define Berlin. Who is inside the circle, who not? So what examples do we have of the struggle to define who is a brother or a sister? And over time, what does it mean to be inside the circle or not?"
Well, let's begin with the founding documents. We're in a state in which we claim that everyone has an equal opportunity to participate in this society, and yet in the founding documents, obviously people of color, women, people who didn't own property were all excluded from the vote and from any participation in society. So that was the definition of equal and of opportunity at that time. It's changed considerably over the last couple hundred years, and I think when we look at who's in the circle and out of the circle now, I think it depends on how exactly you define the circle. If you look at what is actually protected in law in Philadelphia, virtually everyone is inside of the circle of protected classes that are represented in any legislation in the country. If you look at what's actually enforced or what the results are with regard to fairness and equity, what the results are with regard to achievement in our public schools, when you look at the results of who is getting jobs and who is moving up the ladder and ending up in managerial, supervisory, and CEO positions, all of a sudden the circle changes. And women are not in that circle nearly as often as they should be. People of color, people of different ethnic backgrounds, LGBT people, people who are, I'll tell you one category that's not in any law, any protected class law in the entire nation except for Berkeley, California, where it's being challenged in court, is personal appearance. So people who are dramatically overweight are not protected anywhere in this country and probably suffer the greatest amount of discrimination in employment and public accommodations and housing of any group at all, especially when you conflate that with another protected class. So an overweight person who's a person of color, who's a lesbian, who's Hispanic, you can see how this goes. It gets more and more challenging. In any case, I think that it's important to understand that today the circle is quite different. It's much larger and it has a lot of holes in it around the perimeter that are sort of permeable, and people go in and out of the circle as you look at what aspect of their lives you're talking about inclusion or exception. I think you need to understand, all of us together, that what we say and what we do are really quite different with regard to the way in which people are included or protected. And it's one thing to have laws in place, it's another thing to see what the results of those laws are and how people actually are able to define their lives and have opportunities that are provided to them, whether that's in the circle or outside of the circle.
I think I would second your comments. I mean, I think that I agree with pretty much everything you said, beginning with sort of the founding document. I think for me, well, the tack I want to take or talk about is to sort of build a little bit on something that I think Chris had started in his last comment also, is that despite some of that sort of exclusion, that a lot of those groups have managed to, it still sort of fomented some incredible things. So I think about sort of W.E.B. Du Bois, this African-American Harvard-educated scholar who came to the University of Pennsylvania in the late 19th century and was basically, you know, given a broom closet, you know, in which to sort of do his work, but yet he still managed to sort of comb the community and produce this seminal work that is sort of premier for sociology, for historical urban studies, and certainly for African American history, and that's the Philadelphia Negro, right, published in 1896. It's just sort of one example of how, in spite of that exclusion, I think some of the character of the folks who come in and out of this city have still managed to sort of push past some of those obstacles to do some incredible things. And I think that it's that kind of example that I'd like to sort of take away from some of that struggle to sort of continue finding ways to fight and to challenge those boundaries till eventually people push past them.
I'd like to maybe take it in a slightly different direction. When I was thinking about, again, the phrase city of brotherly love, I tried to think about all the words in it, and particularly brother, and what it means to actually love someone like a brother. I have a brother, and I thought about him a lot. I love him to death. And if you watched how over the years we've behaved towards each other, to death might be the opposite. brotherly love, and I think it's really important that if you're talking about whether we're living up to the aspiration of our name, it's important to be clear what brotherly love means. It is not simply civility. It is not decorum. It is not always being nice. And as important as these other, I don't think it's sufficient. It's not improper, but it's not sufficient to look at it merely in the context of rights and legal protection. It's about love. It's about how you look at someone. And brotherly love to me says, and saying you're inside the circle means, you know, no matter what you do, or no matter what I do, we're stuck together. We're tied. There's a bond that can't be broken. That's what it means, brotherly love. It doesn't mean you're always nice, it doesn't mean you're always fair, it doesn't mean you're always just and you're treating each other, but you don't give up on each other. And I actually think Philadelphians are like that to people who they let in the circle. They're incredibly loyal, but that's why they're somewhat stingy with where they draw the circle, because it means so much to be a brother to somebody in Philadelphia. And I guess where I ended in the essay was we have to be a little better at widening the circle and letting more people in, not just in terms of rights and protection, but in terms of actual emotion and feeling who we let in the circle. I think it's a great thing to note that the city of Philadelphia grew in the last census, however mildly, but Chicago didn't, ha! Baltimore didn't. We're still ahead of Phoenix, ha! But there's only one reason for that statistic, the number of immigrants who moved to Philadelphia. And this did not, this was not automatic. This was not in any way guaranteed. We have been a relatively hostile city for immigrants for a long time. And, you know,
we still are.
Yeah. But not apparently as we once were. Because it is immigration by Latinos and Asians that is almost solely responsible for the growth in the city of Philadelphia. The only other class that grew was empty nester baby boomers like me moving into condos, but there aren't that many of them. I mean, really the driver was Latinos and Asians. So they're coming here and they're actually staying longer than they were, or they're not being driven out at quite the pace they were driven out in the 80s and the 90s. And I think that's a great sign about the direction where we're headed.
Larger discussion. And so if you have questions for the panelists, please make sure that your question can be heard by everybody. Great, thanks.
As someone who has sold this city and promoted this city nationally and internationally, I didn't realize that I was promoting such a failed city, such a foul city, such a disgusting city. And I'm surprised that the topic isn't called looking at the hole and not the donut. Isn't there something good about this city that any of you could have thought about?
I think it's a very good point that you're making. Let me just say, I love the city. I moved here 7 years ago. It's my favorite city I've ever lived in, and I've lived in many cities in this country and around the world. So I am an absolute booster for Philadelphia. The topic tonight, though, didn't really allow for that kind of conversation. I can tell you so many things that I love about the city and why I've chosen to be here and want to stay here. So I'm absolutely with you as far as boosting Philadelphia. But I think it's also important, if you're going to proclaim your love, which is part of the brotherly love equation, if you're going to proclaim your love for a city, I think it's also important to be able to have an open, honest conversation about what works and what doesn't work. And I think so much of this is what the lens you see the city through produces for the conversation. And it depends so much upon your own life experience. You know, I'm going to see this, and I say this as somebody who's not a native Philadelphian. All of the stereotypes about Philadelphia that I heard before I moved here were this very parochial city. If you haven't been here three generations, you're never going to be able to be a Philadelphian. Nobody will ever talk to you. It's been the opposite. I've found it the most welcoming, warm, wonderful city. I've made tremendous friends. Everybody's been terrific. So it isn't about that. It's that you see the same set of facts very differently if you come from a very different life experience. So people, for example, the school system is more segregated today here in Philadelphia than it was when Brown versus the Board of Education passed in 1954-55. Okay, now, this isn't the only city for which that's true, but it isn't true in every city in the United States. And we do have to ask ourselves why. Of course it comes from housing patterns, because people go to school near where they live. We don't have busing anymore since 1991 in this country by a Supreme Court decision. So if you are still seeing entirely segregated schools, we have to ask the questions, why is it that people don't want to live near people who are different from them? Why aren't our neighborhoods more integrated? Why is there this sense of separation? Why do we have resentment among various groups? Why is it that, even though Chris is absolutely right, the population, and this is all through Pennsylvania, not just in Philadelphia, for the state of Pennsylvania, 65% of the increase in the 3.8% increase in population in this census is from immigrants that are Spanish-speaking. So there's no question that immigrants are coming here, but then you look to the case that I started out with this evening with regard to Asian Americans and how they're often treated in the public school system. You still have to ask yourself why we're seeing that there's so much friction and so much resentment of difference and change. There's such a sense of unwelcomeness for communities. That doesn't mean individually people aren't being welcomed into the city and don't appreciate every wonderful thing culturally, historically, socially, architecturally. You know, there's so many ways in which the city is a rich, wonderful place to live. But I think it doesn't help us if we try to pretend that the problems aren't extremely serious, very real, and they're very long-standing, and all of us in this room and in the city have to work together to figure out a path out of the problems that we were describing up here. So I don't want you to walk away feeling that there's any animus on my part, because I chose to live here. I could have lived anywhere in the state, and I came to Philadelphia because I adore the city.
Okay. Oh, wait. I actually wanted to respond. There probably is some animus on my part, but I don't think that... I mean, Chris is here talking about love and struggle. I think that that's true, but I think that there's beauty in both sides. That is what makes us sort of admirable, right? Is that we do occupy these different kinds of poles, and in spite of those conflicts, we manage to wring out some amazing achievements. So I don't feel like to talk about or to acknowledge these things is trashing the city or making it look bad. I think we've been at the forefront of a number of things, sometimes not with the best outcomes, but ultimately we will struggle and, you know, fight with each other, I guess, in this sort of brotherly love way until we come out with a better solution. I think that that's what's great.
I just want to share one thing quickly on a positive note. I think if you know any of the younger people who've been transforming neighborhoods like Northern Liberties and Fishtown and Bella Vista and all that in recent years, you know that they have a completely different view of this city, which is enormously positive. I was at an event called Ignite Philly a couple of weeks ago at Johnny Brandis in Fishtown, which is essentially a celebration, mostly youthful, of what's great and interesting and moving in the city. And the tweet of the night, of course they had a tweet of the night, was this. If Portland, Oregon had a love child with New York City, what would it be? The answer is Philadelphia.
I just don't want to think about that.
I don't want to think about it either. Shuddering tonight now.
I'm thoroughly enjoying the show. I'm a lifelong, really serious student of Philadelphia and William Penn and Pennsylvania. And I throw out a thesis with me. I see good people at every generation. I see incidents at every generation. And either those incidents would stir people or just the good people would do something to uplift. And I think that if they're out the thesis that every generation has to define you know, what we call civil rights. And you can write a wonderful book in Pennsylvania, particularly.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
Well said.
I think we're leaving a very big part of William Penn's idea of brotherly love out of the picture. We're moving his idea of love also included the refusal to bear arms and to create war. There was no tax collected in Pennsylvania for war for a long time. And that goes along with the meeting and has something fundamental to the idea of brotherly love. If you mentioned not long ago that west of the Susquehanna was a lot different from the east side of the Susquehanna.
Well, west of city
well,
line.
That's where it seemed to change. And there's a good reason for it. The group that were interested in eliminating war worked up the Susquehanna on this side because people were coming from West Virginia and other places, George Washington among them, and causing trouble with the Indians out there. And so the people that followed that part of Penn's brotherly love moved up, and you'll find friends meetings all the way up the Susquehanna that died dead at the Susquehanna. And I think that when you're going to talk about brotherly love, that part of Penn's hopes and wishes have to be in it. And we're having horrible wars today.
Agreed.
Thank you for making the point.
Yeah.
I think it's a very important part.
I agree.
Yes.
I have a question for the panel, and that is, as I was listening to you describe the experience of the groups in Philadelphia, one thing that that I noticed was that it seemed that people's experience in some ways has more to do with their level of education than really the group that they belong to. In other words, knowing what your rights are and how to progress despite shortcomings in the law or in attitudes that people might have to toward the group that you happen to belong to seem to make a difference in some of the examples that you are using. I myself am not a native Philadelphian. I'm from Miami, and I'm a first-generation American. My parents are Cuban. I came to Philadelphia by way of D.C., and when I describe it to people, I say it is the least pretentious city I've ever lived in, because people are just themselves, and they sort of take you at face value. But what I'm finding in the different people that I'm meeting is that their ability to exercise their rights and the experience that they have with other groups tends to be more linked to their level of education than it does to necessarily skin color or ethnicity or sexual orientation or whatever else.
I think that actually, if I may answer that first, I think that actually is true generally, but there are exceptions. And I think it's important to acknowledge the exceptions. When there was a school board meeting of the School Reform Commission almost 3 years ago now, the governor asked me to testify on his behalf. And the room was packed, 500 people. It was about what we thought would be the most innocuous possible issue, which was naming October as LGBT History Month. Not assigning any change in the curriculum, not assigning any funds to it or anything else. Just, you know, because there was a Women's History Month, there was an Hispanic History Month, there was an African American History Month, they just wanted to have an LGBT History Month. Well, it turned into such a melee and so much incredible bias and prejudice and bigotry that was hurled around the room. And the speakers, there were only six of us on each side of this who were allowed to speak. So all of the speakers on the other side of this issue were opposed to this. One was a physician, one was a PhD from Penn, one was a master's degree and public school teacher. Every one of them was well educated, and yet the bile and hate and epithets that were spewing out of these people's mouths was simply astonishing. And the Inquirer commented on it in editorials as well as the reportage that was done. It was just amazing to me. It was an eye-opening experience. It was actually the first time for me, and I do a lot of testifying and public speaking and representing the former governor, at least. And I was floored at the fact that there was such a lack of intersection between education and a higher level of understanding and appreciation and of openness and receptivity to difference, etc. Even if you have a different feeling or a different religious belief, that there's a certain level of respect. But what I've found that's really important for us all to acknowledge is that tolerance is absolutely not enough. It's way too low a bar. We need to elevate this conversation to respect and acknowledgement of one another's contributions, and to understand that there's a richness that's added to this society, particularly in a city like this, by all of the different groups that are represented here, and that what we've done is simply lower our expectations by asking only for tolerance. And if you ask yourself that question, does anybody only want to be put up with? Does anybody only want to be tolerated? I'm sorry, that's not high enough for me. And I think until we demand more of ourselves, the dialogue tends to stay at a lower level than it needs to.
The love the gentleman spoke of here, the brotherly love, has disappeared in the people you were talking about, even though they were well educated.
And that doesn't mean everybody. There are a lot of great people here in Philadelphia, because I think your point is very well taken. I don't want this to seem like it's a slam on Philadelphia.
I would like to hear some discussion from the panel regarding the historical meaning of brotherly love. What William Penn meant by it, or might have meant by it.
Okay.
I'm slightly curious to me whether he gave the name to the city before he got here, or
it's
afterwards.
It's kind of that, but okay.
You grab this one.
I remember talking to the people of the Germantown Friends, and related readings, that the people who founded Germantown were actually Mennonites, and they asked a Lutheran to lead them, Pastorius. And when they got here, they set up a Friends meeting. So, did William Penn suppose in the beginning that Pennsylvania was going to be predominantly Quaker, and then realize that Quakerism as a state religion didn't make sense? Or what did brotherly love mean to him? Did it mean something specifically to do with the Quakers? Or did it mean something specifically to do with the holy experiment of religious pluralism? Was that an afterthought?
Can we defer to our Penn scholar here?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at.
What did William Penn mean? That's what I'm
And I'm looking at Gene. But hold on, before I just want to say one thing. I just want to backtrack and say one thing about the education piece, and we can talk about the William Penn thing. I do agree that educational access, the only question from Native Miami Native, I'm actually jealous. I do agree that education certainly gives folks a different level of access, but I also think that we can't sort of divorce folks' ability to attain education from issues of race and class. Right, so not everybody has the same avenue for that kind of educational access. And the higher up you go, right, the sort of more tiered it becomes. So that is that piece. But then with respect to your question about William Penn, I mean, I do think a part of it was the holy experiment. I think that's what is, but I don't think it's an afterthought. I think it's all sort of encompassing. And I was actually going to then defer to Gene. So
I don't think it was an afterthought. It was a single sentence in a letter that he wrote to one of his aides who was in Pennsylvania, where he said, "I would have the city named Philadelphia." And so we have to imagine, to a certain extent, exactly what he meant. But from other actions and directives that he gave, it's clear that he wanted to have peace with the Native Americans who were here. It's clear that he did want to welcome people of different religions and ethnicities, although there was a limit as to who could participate in government. Only those who believed in Christ could participate in government, although those who believed in Almighty God could live here and worship here. He certainly expected the Quakers to take a leading role in the government, but he
found very quickly that that did not mean a peaceful, united government. And therefore, he had a lot of challenges in terms of getting cooperation from the Quakers who were here. And then as time went on, Anglicans came, established a church as they could under the Quaker, under the Charter, and they also challenged both Penn's authority and the government of the Quakers. So what he expected was quickly disabused in some ways, but in others, I think he set a standard for Philadelphia.
In the first place, in terms of religious freedom.
Yes, I think that was probably the first, but very clearly it was important to maintain peace with the Native Americans.
Gene, if I could just jump in quickly, I wanted to get back to the thing just very quickly about education. I think the gentleman over here said every generation sort of has a test on civil rights. I really think what you said is exactly right, and that is the test of our generation's brotherly love. Whether we actually believe that children who don't look like us and don't live near us deserve to have an education. And actually, I think Philadelphia put in a reasonably decent effort in the last 8 years on the School Reform Commission, starting to at least figure out how to get that right. And I think we are about to aggressively and rapidly flunk that test now. And we are going to give up on that goal, and we are going to botch the biggest test for our generation.
Okay, we're at the point where we're going to break into groups, and Charlene is going to lead that effort. But thank you very much.
Because we can continue to discuss them now. We want to give everyone a chance to participate and speak more directly, either with panelists or with the encyclopedia editors are here. So we have some discussion facilitators within our audience. It looks to me like the group is a little bit more packed up on this side in the front of the room. So first of all, Frank, you wave your hand, Frank. Frank, well, if you'll come up to these first 2 to 3 rows here. And Jerry, if you'll wave your hand. Jerry, there's Jerry. In the center on the side, if you'll circle around Jerry. Melissa, I'm going to ask you to move over to that side of the room. And the people in the back on that side can meet with you. Howard, wave your hand. Howard is one of our encyclopedia editors. You'll have around here, and Rebecca Gaiman, also one of our encyclopedia editors here. So if you'll just circle your chairs with those folks, we have about 20 minutes for some ongoing discussion this evening. Thank you.